Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss, another kiss.
Hello, my name is Tom Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we will be discussing and spoiling A Single Man, starring Colin Firth and Julianne Moore, directed by Tom Ford. I am here today with Christopher Morosky. Hello, Christopher.
It's Tanqueray Morosky.
And also Kelly Wand is here as well. Hello, Kelly Wand.
Hey, I can't do my catchphrase yet.
Kelly Wand, do you have a catchphrase this week that relates to A Single Man or not?
No, I just have a catchphrase that doesn't relate.
That's fine. Rock and roll.
All right. After I saw Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, or Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, whatever it's called, I saw it with my friend who likes everything. And then after the credits came up at the end, I was disappointed. And then he went, why? So my catchphrase to this week is why.
Okay, good. We'll try to revisit that.
Let me redo all that.
Can you make it sort of more concise? Can you sort of?
I screwed up all my. No. Next week's catchphrase will be one word long, as opposed to why.
Good. Okay.
Yeah. Hey Tom, was that you singing the intro song?
You have a really great voice. If it's not you.
I don't. So Kelly Wand, you recommended a song called Green Onion, and I had no idea what the heck that was.
It's Green Onion.
Green Onion.
Green Onion.
Plays in A Single Man. It's famous from American Graffiti. It's by Booker T and the MGs. It's that instrumental that they jam to.
Because everybody knows that music. When she puts it on, it's immediately familiar, I think, to anyone in the audience. So I was like, oh, yeah, that song. Yeah. But I had no idea it was called Green Onion.
Green Onions. Onions.
Stop doing that.
So what that was, so here's, again, my half-assed approach to intro music. That was just a Doors song.
Because the Doors were big in 1962. When
they were going to be in 3 years, you see.
Right.
I was thinking, okay, that's the sort of, and it's a wistful song, and it's about kissing someone right before they die, which is how Single Man opens, although it's not, except for the right before part. So that was my thought process. So there you go. That was the Doors.
And it's kind of slow motion-y. Like
it's dreamlike, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's soporific.
Language.
Yeah, language.
I like language.
It's Terrence Malick, but minus the fun.
So,
That's on the poster, I think, actually.
Terrence Malick minus the fun.
So did anybody know, by the way? Oh, also, I should say, anybody listening to this podcast right now, you know what? It's 2010. Now, I say that because there is no way anybody really has seen this movie before 2010. Little did I realize this movie was only released to two theaters in Los Angeles so that it could qualify Colin Firth for a Best Actor nomination for the Academy Awards. It'll open, I think it'll have another limited release, not as limited, in, I believe, January or it's...
Doesn't having a wide release help more, though? I don't understand why you would release it in one theater and call that an effort.
To meet the rules. I mean, it's strictly a matter of qualifying for these strange rules for what it takes to be allowed to be nominated for an Academy Award. And I did.
So they don't actually expect their own voters to see it.
Well, there will be screener copies sent out to the people in the Academy. But this is a technicality, and I didn't realize this. I saw a trailer for it, and I knew nothing else about it, which I kind of also want to talk about. So nobody nobody out there listening has seen this movie yet. So by the time anybody will have seen this movie, it's going to be 2010. So if you guys have anything to say to 2010, you can do that now.
On top of how much interest your average quarter to three poster will have in A Single Man inherently.
Well, let's talk about that because my interest. Wait. Oh, go ahead, Dingus. Did you have something to say to 2010?
Yeah, I just want to ask: Did we make contact?
Good question. We'll find out.
Tom didn't get it. What a weasel!
Oh, I don't like Stanley Kubrick sequels.
Ah, it's Peter Hyams. The rich man, Stanley Kubrick. He's your favorite living director. I mean, didn't we go over that last week? Wes Anderson.
Peter Hyams. I am the one person on this podcast who likes 2010 more than 2001.
Zing! No!
Can I be in your club, Dingus?
There's dolphins! There's dolphins! In the house! Inside the house! Sorry, go ahead, Tom.
I want to be in that club. I like that club.
Helen Mirren.
Oh, wow, Helen that's Mirren. Right!
It's a Russian accent.
Rebuttal, Kelly Wand.
You guys are dumb.
Well, now that we've closed that argument.
I think Yakov Smirnov is in it as
right.
well.
Hey, what a natural transition to my question in general about movies. What was the first movie you guys saw?
This week?
Yeah. No, from the womb onward.
That's a 3x3 question.
Well, there's not three. Well, I guess there's three of us.
First right, movies that you it. Saw.
I wanted to know the first movie you saw and the first R-rated movie you saw.
I actually saw Rosemary's Baby when I was in the womb with my mom.
That's sweet.
I have no, I don't know. I could talk about early memories of the first movies I've seen, but that has nothing really to do with Single Man's.
All right, this isn't going anywhere. Let's get back to the gay movie.
Bring that up as your 3x3 sometime. I like. If you want. Well obviously, so Kelly Wan, you obviously recall the first movie you saw. What was it?
Charlotte's Web.
Okay. Now, that's a cartoon. That's not a movie.
It was in a movie theater. Okay. And then the first R-rated movie I saw was Animal House, which was a really seminal movie-going experience. Because right. with my dad, so it's kind of like passing the torch, like in a Cormac McCarthy novel.
Now you're going to have to. Now that you've segued into this, I invite you to find a segue to A Single Man. Go. Good luck.
Single Man. Much like my dad would have said, is the gayest movie I've ever seen, with the possible exception of 300 and Avatar.
I did not know that it was going to be a gay movie.
I didn't either, and I sat with my mom.
You're lying. You didn't.
I swear to God. I left a tree trimming party full of old folks to see this movie with my mom and her boyfriend.
And
in the second row on the left.
Because it was crowded, because it's only at one screen. Is that the deal?
Yeah. So it was like being a Siamese twin where you crouched. Like
I can't believe you're saying this is the gayest movie you've ever seen, and then you say the phrase "I left a tree trimming party,"
or as I call it, a Brazilian party.
Okay.
But it was pretty gay.
Wait a minute, Tom, did you say you had watched a trailer for this film?
So I was it was some arty thing that we were seeing. I forget what it was. Something I was seeing for this podcast. And it had trailers for foreign films. For instance, there was a trailer for White Ribbon, which is the Michael Haneke movie that opens at the end of this year that I really want to see.
Oh, God, I almost – sorry to cut you off. I almost accidentally watched before this film.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, you know, it's in German. What do I care? But I went in and closed my eyes anyway. And then I glanced up when the title came up and I went, holy cow.
Good work. And that's one too, where you can just close your eyes and it's okay to listen because I don't speak German. So I have no idea what's being said. they could be disclosing the final plot twist for all I know. And I don't speak German.
I thought you were a theology major.
You know, you're joking, but theology majors actually have to know German and some French,
Latin.
But mainly German, because a lot of the early biblical scholarship is written in German. You were making a joke, but it was also true to life. Like all.
Well, maybe I was being true to life, and you're making the joke.
Good. So anyway, I was going to see something that had trailers for foreign films in front of it, and imagery comes up of Colin Firth with those awesome glasses and his hair. And I realized, too, it's part of why I respond to the trailer for 9, is that he looks like someone in an Italian movie, which I love that.
Yeah.
The trailer is playing, and then there's Julianne Moore. And I do vaguely recall either it shows the gun or it shows that slow motion scene. It's almost from Taxi Driver, where he's making the gun with his hand, and he's pointing at the little kid. I think in the trailer you don't realize he's pointing at the little kid. And I immediately closed my eyes and thought, whatever this is, I want to see it. And so the title flashes up. It's getting, of course, some Oscar buzz. I now realize very intentionally it's very calculated. So I didn't know anything about it and had no idea that it was going to be, as Kelly Wan put it, so gay. Although I want to talk about how gay it was.
Well, it's by fashion designer Tom Ford.
Who is gay, yes.
Who's super.
And the author, Christopher Isherwood. Oh, good Lord, I meant to not.
No, you're right. Right. Isherwood
is also gay. So it's very much a movie with two gay men behind it. It's a sort of creative driving forces behind it.
It's gay the way Dubliners is Irish.
I like that. I don't know what it means because I haven't seen Dubliners. I don't do sports movies.
Well, it's a book.
It's actually
James Joyce. Oh, okay. Good Lord. You guys, you can't segue into literature like that and not warn us.
Well, I thought since Dublin was part of it, I go, even if Tom doesn't know what Dubliners is, which wouldn't surprise me, he'll never
mind. I'm gonna lay down some politically correct smackdown on you guys real quick. When we're saying it's gay, are we being pejorative, ladies and gentlemen?
Please.
Both.
All right.
I'm not being pejorative at all. I mean, it's clearly about – well, let's get into this. How much is it about homosexuality and how much is it just about love? And I would argue it's primarily just about love. The fact that it is a gay relationship is almost incidental.
Well, no. I think that his speech about minorities and fears is a key.
Right.
And also the things they say about invisibility. So it's not just – I mean, I get what you're saying, but it's specific to this particular minority, I think. Or maybe it's more trying to make a statement about minorities in general, but I think it's specific to this particular to homosexuality, to gayness.
Part of why I liked it so much is I kind of disagree with that, Dingus.
Okay.
It is specific to that, but not in any sort of way – that makes it where someone who is heterosexual feels like he's looking at something alien or other.
I agree with that. I agree with that.
It's very accessible. I for instance, if you think of like a Greg Araki movie, the homosexuality in that is very confrontational, and it's very much sort of pushing it, keeping it arm's length, straight guys like us. It's got this sort of, we're here, we're queer, deal with it, it's in your face kind of thing. I never got that sense. I didn't get that sense much from the central relationships in A Single Man. It didn't have that sort of alien feel. And one of the things I want to talk about tonight, or this afternoon, depending on when you're listening, or this morning, is
in 2010.
Or yeah, next year.
While you're watching 2010,
is how that relates to Brokeback Mountain, which is another movie where I felt the same thing.
Yeah.
And which I watched immediately after seeing this, by the way. So
I felt that more. I felt your point was more true in Brokeback Mountain than in this. In this, I thought it was a little bit of gay exploitation. Like, there's some shots where just there's a butt in the foreground, and if it was about heterosexuals and it was a butt in the foreground, I'd go, ah.
I think that has more to do with the specific moment that we're dealing with in his life. But I'm really happy that you saw Brokeback Mountain, because there are a couple things that I wanted to compare to that movie, and I haven't seen it since that year, and I'm glad somebody saw that again.
Kelly Wand, have you seen Brokeback Mountain? Because when you say this is the gayest movie you've seen since 300.
It's totally gayer than Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, so you have seen Brokeback. Okay, good.
Yeah, I like Brokeback Mountain. I didn't really care about it till I saw it, and then after I saw it, I was annoyed when Crash beat it for Best Picture. Because it's about it's like what you said. It's just about a love that dare not speak its name. It's about a forbidden, like you can't get someone that you should be with.
Well, here's one place where I thought this was a very different movie and less about being gay. This was a gay relationship in Los Angeles in 1962, and the movie almost never explored how they were discriminated against, or that they felt in danger, or they were very, you know, they lived literally in a glass house. And I really respected that. And I enjoyed that aspect of it, of seeing a movie about a gay relationship that didn't have all this stuff about being persecuted because you're gay. This movie assumed, you know, it was set in a place where it was assumed that, yes, that was an issue, but it wasn't the central issue of being gay. The central issue of being gay in this movie was being in love with someone who happened to be another man. And there was very little, Dingus, you mentioned the speech he gives to the class about minorities and about fear. And I, at that point, I was thinking, okay, this is going to be a movie that really explores that aspect of being gay. And beyond that speech, I felt it really didn't. It kind of ignored that stuff, and I was okay with that.
Well, I will have to disagree because of how strongly I felt the theme of invisibility, and especially in that incredible telephone scene with John Hamm, or I forget the character's name, Ackerley maybe, the brother. That incredible telephone scene really, really laid that down on the table. Didn't you think that?
Yes, and that would be the other point where I think their being gay was a liability, and it really did bring to light the difficulty of being gay. But I will grant you that scene. But beyond that scene, can you think of other instances?
Well, I think of the way Julianne Moore deals with him, and he has a pretty big blow up with her, and part of it is in the midst of their drunken revelry. Mm-hmm. Where I forget what exactly she says, but she basically says what you're going through is just a mask for
right.
something else or a substitution for something
right.
else, and he has to go off on her. And then there's all the dancing around he has to do in not really being clear about who he is to the people around him and saying, I can't talk about these things to Potter. What's the kid, Mr. Potter's
Kevin.
First name?
Not Kevin. Kenny.
Kenny,
thank you. So I think it's a very big part of
it. So real quick, I think that point though with Julianne Moore wasn't so much about him being gay; it's her not just really understanding his love for someone besides her.
I thought it was the alcohol.
You could almost see that in if he was with another woman. She could almost say to him, you know, oh, you were married to this much younger woman, but that was a diversion. I think it was just a matter of the fact that she didn't understand his relationship. So she discounted it. That made him angry at that moment. He corrected her and she apologized. And the things with Kenny Dingus seemed to me like the same kind of dancing around that anybody has to do when you are breaching the possibility of sexuality in a relationship. Not just when you know, it's obviously I think Kenny was gay. I think they knew that about each other, but there was the difficulty of the fact that that was his student and
there's a cat involved apparently as well. I think that's a bigger hurdle I think you're giving that a little bit of short shrift because I understand what you're trying to say as far as the difficulty of broaching that subject with anybody. But also having to go through that in 1962 and not, you can't come out and say, do you like guys? Do you like girls? And they have to dance around it and dance around it and dance around it. Now, part of that is also, what the nature of their relationship is supposed to be. And I'm really quite interested in going into because there's a lot of different layers that the relationship of George and Kenny can represent and where we're supposed to think that's going. I'm fascinated by what we're supposed to think of that relationship. But just looking at it on the point of view of two people meeting and going through that first dance of is you is or is you ain't kind of a thing. Also having to go through the layer of we have to figure out if you like girls or you like boys is a huge and difficult thing to go through and much more difficult than I think you're suggesting here. But I respect what you're saying as far as this being a story about love primarily and not about homosexuality. But I think that telephone conversation had more of an impact on me for a couple of reasons than maybe it had on you.
Well, I love that scene. I mean, that's one of the great – I love telephone scenes because I know how challenging they are for actors. So to see one done well is an amazing bit of work. So I love that scene. It was great. It certainly had impact on me in terms of its place in the movie. But I guess what I'm saying, Dingus, and we can sort of move on after this, is that unlike other movies with gay characters, I didn't feel that the issue of homosexuality was worn on its sleeve quite so blatantly. Things were explored. I mean, there are aspects of that that don't come up in movies about heterosexual relationships, but they did not sit front and center, and they didn't in any way impact whether or not I could resonate with the characters. You know, whether everything, the fact that, you know, I'm not into dudes, George was, but I did not have any problem empathizing with his character and sort of feeling the emotional impact of what Colin Firth was doing because of that. Whereas in other movies about gay characters, that is an issue for me.
Well, I think I agree with that last statement, Tom. And as you said that, it occurs to me that the film that this most reminded me of as I watched it was a film about a heterosexual relationship and not one about a gay relationship. This film far more reminded me of that movie rather than, say, Brokeback Mountain.
Right. Okay, and what was that movie? You can't just drop that.
That movie was The Fountain.
What? You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
The Fountain. Okay.
Go ahead.
But go ahead.
Call him out, Kelly Wand. Also, yeah, there you go.
I don't know what he's talking
about.
Get
him.
But I'm curious. I don't know what he means. I don't know what angle to get him at.
This, I don't know quite how to express it, perhaps, but this film, from the opening shot of the body in the water and the snow, and then moving on to the snow and the layers of going back in time and going forward in time and dealing with the present, the past, and the future, and also just the way music was used and texture was used, it constantly brought The Fountain to mind, and I have a very special place in my heart for the Fountain, and also just the subject of grief and the way both films deal with the subject of grief.
Did that work for you, Kelly Wand? Are you buying that?
Some of it. I have that. The similarity. There's when the cinematography goes all rich, when he's kind of having a moment of clarity, like even the smog super rich. That's kind of like The Fountain, where the present is all sort of leached out. I think that's one thing I would concede, Dingus. But I agree with Tom in that. Didn't seem, even though it was the gayest movie I've ever seen, I don't think it was about gayness in that I got the sense most of the people he knew he was gay or thought he was gay and didn't mind it because he's English anyway, so they just assume it. And every guy he met in that day was gay. Like, he meets the guy at the bar, the liquor store. The Spanish guy. He just seemed to live in a gay universe, and I didn't get the sense that they were forcing that. It was meant for gay people to enjoy.
Well, I don't agree. I mean, but I think Dingus is on to something, Kelly Wand, that has to do with you and I sort of saying that it's not, even though it's very much a movie about gay characters, it's not about the act of being gay. I think Dingus is right in that, like The Fountain, it is about love, the interplay of love and grief. It's about how you get past to that. It's about accepting death in a way. If you say that the movie, like I'm saying, is not about being gay, then what is it about? You know, what is the approach it takes to being about love in a relationship? And I very much agree with what Dingus is saying about The Fountain. It's about love and grief and how you come to terms with the fact that you will lose the one that you love. So I gotta decide things. It's 2-1.
Yeah, in The Fountain, when he dies, it's sort of a reawakening and a rebirth, and I guess that's what we were supposed to get out of this. I guess I was puzzled by, I mean, because he spoiler alert, he dies at the end without trying to.
You know what? I'm sorry to blurt out here, but what was most interesting to me in looking at his death was sort of comparing. This is a little easy because of the titles. Was comparing his death at the end and the way the end resolved, so to speak, to the end of A Serious Man, and dealing with death in those two films. That was fascinating to me.
And the theme of A Serious Man is that it's all sort of out of your hands. And your fate is sealed and there's not much you can do about it. While as in The Fountain, the guy had free will and it was sort of about his animating events around him. Mm-hmm. And this was more like A Serious Man. I got the sense he didn't plan the heart attack.
No, but there's a sense to me that, and I think you might have alluded to this a minute ago, Kelly, that there's a sense to me that there's something about liberation at the end of this, and as opposed to a sense of inevitability in A Serious Man.
And it was fascinating to me to watch these two films because they're both period pieces. They both have professors in them. Yeah. And they have these qualities that are very similar to me. And I would, and I think if they had been made in different years, you would have think is somebody cribbing from somebody else. It was fascinating to me to have discussed or to have been about to discuss both of these films. It was just a fascinating thing for me, and I forgot that. And I'm sorry I just jumped on you, Kelly, because when you talked about the end, all of a sudden I remembered my reaction thinking about him lying on the floor as opposed to that tornado.
I see a lot of continuity with the end of the fountain, though. The message of the fountain is this acceptance of death. And there's that same thing right at the end of A Single Man. It's very... you know, I'll get a little classical here, but the whole concept behind Hamlet that the readiness is all. It's very much that with A Single Man is he kind of has to accept death and not chase it and not and sort of accept his lover's death. And once that readiness is there, then he can die and it's okay. It's sort of like he doesn't have to chase it. I mean, and there's also it's such a weird dramatic irony to have a movie about a character who's going to commit suicide and then changes his mind and then dies anyway. Which I wasn't quite sure what to make of that either at the time.
Well, what did you make of that shot towards the end where he takes the gun and that the guy finds, Kenny has the gun?
I did not know what to make of Kenny. I was convinced for a long time that Kenny was going to be an imaginary character.
He was Harvey. He was the gay Harvey.
Or his younger self or something like that. But I don't think that's what they were going for. I mean, I think Kenny was a student who was genuinely concerned about him and asked after him. And I think everything that you find out about Kenny is, in fact, what's going on with Kenny. I'm not sure there were any secret layers there.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, but what I was just going to say was wondering about those things is, and this is me doing a little product, just saying something about not watching trailers, is that I didn't know what this movie was going to be. So I don't know who Kenny's going to be. I don't know if he's going to turn out to be a guardian angel. At the beginning, when George is walking to the snow, to the car wreck, I don't know if this is going to be like a Fargo kind of situation, a serial killer. I don't know if when he goes to the bank, he's going to take that gun out. I don't know anything that's going to happen. And when you go to a movie and don't know anything that's going to happen, it's so wonderful.
Right.
You know, when I got the sense that Kenny was sort of a guardian angel type of character, not that he wasn't real, but that's the role he was playing in this man's life. And so when he finds the gun, like on Kenny for a second, I was thinking, did Kenny kill himself? No, he didn't kill himself. He's okay.
Dingus.
And then he locks it away, and then he goes in the room, and there is that sort of thing that you talked about, Tom, this sort of acceptance and liberation, and then death comes. But it comes more naturally, I think, because then – I don't know what he says. His quote is something, and then so suddenly he came, or right – you know, that Jim, I think it is, Jim walks in just as he walked in on Jim in his dream.
Right. But they're both dreams. Because Jim's dead before the movie starts.
Right.
Not that means anything. Did it distract either of you guys that everyone kept telling him throughout the movie how terrible he looked? And he
yes!
Really looked that terrible?
I hate that in movies.
It was like the kid in the road.
I hate that in movies. I hate when someone says...
Man, you look horrible.
Yeah. And then the character has to say, oh, I've...
All that makeup on.
And especially when it's said to someone as dashing, like, I don't... I mean, I'm not gay, but wasn't... Colin Firth looked really good in this, right? Like...
He did.
Man, and I think that's kind of what I was responding to in the trailers, too, is in that suit with the glasses and his hair. I mean, I wish I looked like that and when people try to tell him you look terrible, you know, have you not been sleeping? I'm like, what are you talking about? This guy looks awesome. He should be going to some kind of modeling photo shoot right now or something.
Because it's easy to fake sleepiness looking. Like if you can use makeup to put bags out of the eyes, but they didn't even do that. And this is a fashion designer, like, who was the tension of imagery and visual detail. So I was surprised by that.
So did you guys know before? I guess you didn't know before, but have you since found out who Tom Ford is, the director of this movie? He's a first-time director.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that much about him. I just know that, like Kelly said earlier,
he's not just a fashion designer, but he was the creative director of Gucci and then later Yves Saint Laurent for 10 years or whatever. And he quit 5 years ago. He has his own line of fashion now, and I guess he's wanting to make movies. But this is a guy who, you know, that's his whole background, is running not just like making clothes and stuff, but running Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent. And he goes on to make this movie. He also, those of us who aren't gay might remember, and I didn't remember this. So on Vanity Fair, I forget when this was, maybe 2 years ago, Scarlett Johansson and Keira Knightley appeared in the nude, you know, tactically posed so you couldn't really see anything. And I remembered that cover because there was some buzz about it because, you know, there's these hot chicks and they're naked on Vanity Fair. Tom Ford was posing with them. And when I was Googling who Tom Ford was,
yes.
I was like, wait, there was a dude on that cover? I had no idea.
But it's okay because he's gay.
Right.
So it's like three women.
So I was looking up that cover and I was like, oh yeah, there's a guy like over there right next to Keira Knightley. And I didn't remember him there, but that was Tom Ford.
He was invisible. He was,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. And during the credits, I don't know if you guys noticed, but it says Colin Firth's suit by Tom Ford Fashion. Because at that point, I didn't know that he was a fashion designer. I was like, oh, that's funny. You know, the director probably just loaned him one of his suits and he gets a credit. But he's got his own line of fashion. So,
did you know he was gay before you saw the movie? And did you know he was gay after you saw the movie, before you looked it up?
I did not, and I only know because he's apparently open about it, of course. I don't think being gay, like, it's sort of like Ang Lee doing Brokeback Mountain. And right. It's another reason that I think him being gay had no real bearing on what happened in the movie, I'm guessing, how it turned out.
Well, I think this story was pretty important for him to tell, and I think that has something to do with him being gay, don't you?
But, you know, no,
I mean,
this
is the first thing he chooses to tell, and it's based on a novel by a man who had a relationship at least somewhat similar to what we see in the movie, at least as far as age is concerned, and it's a fairly famous relationship. And I think this sort of this issue of relationship and partnership and invisibility and minorityship, I think these are important issues, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's telling the story. Now, I certainly haven't looked up. I could be totally wrong. He might have just gotten this instead of getting to do 2012. But I think this is specific to him because at the end, and the one thing I did research is that it says it's dedicated to Richard Buckley,
oh, yeah.
who is his partner.
Ah.
And his partner had been diagnosed with cancer, and when he got over cancer, they moved to Italy, and they were going to have a child, and I don't know what else happened to them, but that coupled with the whole story of Christopher
Isherwood.
Leads me to think that this is a more personal story than just this is the first movie I wanted to make because this is the first thing I could get my hands on.
But I don't think necessarily him being gay is important to it. I mean, obviously it's a personal story, but again, I just want to keep going back to I just have a hard time thinking this is a gay movie because it's so intensely about the loss of love and grief and how you deal with that. And being gay is, I maintain, just incidental to it. I mean, it's just one facet. It's like him being British. It means just as much in this movie as him being British means.
Well, you know, I like where you're going with that, Tom, but I think that I think I would flip it to say that the point is that you're getting that this is universal. I mean, it's still maybe the point he's trying to make is that we go through this too, and that he's getting that across is maybe the
okay.
point. That these things are universal, but I need you guys to know that we go through it too.
Fair enough. Yeah.
You know, the thing, and I apologize for going back to the telephone conversation, but it just had such an effect on me. There's this moment in it where he asks I think it's the brother who's calling him about the dogs.
Right.
And
yeah, what happened to the other dog?
Well, that's the thing. The brother says, I haven't heard anyone mention another dog. And so there's the moment where George says, I'll book a flight to the funeral, and the brother says, well, it's only for family, and he has to deal with that. But I'm thinking also later when he's with the dog that's just like his dog outside the liquor store, and he's smelling the dog and he's talking to the woman. And And this dog is a part of his life. And he has no recourse to find out what happened to this dog. He can't go to the family. If the mother that they make fun of in that beautiful little scene where they're sitting on the couch reading, if the mother has just decided to adopt the dog or if the dog has disappeared, he has no recourse to call anybody or to go there and find that dog. It's gone from his life, just as sure as Jim is gone from his life. And he can't confirm Jim's death any more than he can confirm the dog's death. It's like he's lost a child and he has no way to go find it. And this
he
is
could
specific.
Send Julianne Moore to find it. He could send yeah. her there to find it.
That would be a good idea. But I was just so struck by that level of grief, not just grief, but not knowing, and how specific that was to his situation. He was invisible and he had no recourse.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, and I'm glad you brought up Brokeback Mountain, and I'll shut up after saying this. I was thinking of the difference between that and when I think it's Heath Ledger goes to the family's house and smells all the clothes. You know, the difference between those two moments.
Well, there's where I'm going to have to disagree, because the moments are very – so in Brokeback Mountain, first of all, one of the differences is Brokeback Mountain takes place over, I don't know, 20, 30 years. Whereas a single man takes place in a single day. This is about one day in the life. This guy decides, I'm going to commit suicide tonight. It's about that day. Brokeback Mountain spans a much longer span of time. And so major spoilers coming up for Brokeback Mountain. But in the course of the movie, after their lifelong relationship, Jake Gyllenhaal dies. And Heath Ledger only finds out because they're sending postcards back and forth to coordinate their trips together. Heath Ledger gets one back that says deceased stamped on it. So he calls Jake Gyllenhaal's wife, and it's the same kind of phone conversation. Jake Gyllenhaal's wife does not know that he's gay and doesn't know about the relationship, but he can't ask certain things, and he can't let on sort of the significance of what's happened. And what he really wants to know. And the remarkable thing in Brokeback Mountain is that while it's Anne Hathaway who plays Jake Gyllenhaal's wife, by the way, I'd forgotten about that. While Anne Hathaway is explaining to Heath Ledger what happened, that Jake Gyllenhaal was changing a tire, that something went wrong and he got hit in the face by the jack or something, and he got knocked unconscious and he choked on his own blood, and that's how he died. While Anne Hathaway is explaining this to Heath Ledger, there are shots of Jake Gyllenhaal being beaten to death by other men. Mm. And what this, I think, is this, and they've talked about how dangerous it is to be gay. Heath Ledger recalls at one point in the movie being shown the body of a gay man who'd been murdered by his own, maybe by his own father. His father takes the two boys out and points to a man who'd been murdered because he was gay. So this is Heath Ledger imagining what actually happened. And the movie never tells us whether or not that's what happened, and Heath Ledger never knows. It's that same kind of thing where he's cut off from the normal process of grief for losing a loved one because they're gay.
Right.
So.
And his mind automatically thinks the worst.
Exactly, because that's what he fears. That's what he was shown as a child. So I'd forgotten that it does that weird thing where you see Jake Gyllenhaal being beat to death, even though Heath Ledger doesn't have any way of knowing, and even though it's absolutely not what he's being told.
I forgot that as well. All I could see in my head was Heath Ledger showing up at the house. Am I remembering that correctly? And the mother's sort of sympathetic, and he gets
and
to
the
go
dad's
upstairs.
Well, that's the thing is the father either knows or suspects, and the mother surreptitiously lets him know, yes, I know it was happening, yes, I sympathize.
And sneaks him the clothes.
No, he finds the shirt.
No, but she gives him
nope.
to him.
He goes upstairs to the bedroom. He finds the shirt, and when he comes downstairs with it, the mother knows what it is. She gives him a bag to carry it in, and she takes it from him and wraps it up while they're making eye contact. I mean, it's an incredible moment. It's the sort of emotional crescendo of Brokeback Mountain. But clearly the mother is sympathetic to what was going on, and the father isn't. And Heath Ledger is having to navigate that difficult situation right there. And it did remind me a lot of Brokeback Mountain was more, it wasn't as intimate in terms of the scope of the storytelling. It was set as it was in, I guess, Wyoming, with that big, beautiful landscape all around. a single man was so sensual, literally, in how textured it was, and the importance of smell. And I think, doesn't Colin Firth, when he's talking to the woman at school who says, hey, somebody asked about your address, I gave it to him, does he guess her perfume or something?
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
So it was some, I was like, I'm not into that stuff enough to know what was going on. But you know, it was so into smell and light and the texture of fabrics. And it was just so sensual.
He also talks about the way the dog smells.
Yeah.
He says, I think it smells like buttered bread or something like that.
Yeah. That's Fountain-esque, actually.
So. The way dogs smell?
Well,
the texture, right.
Yeah, and hairs. Like, he's conscious of flesh and, like, like when it's panning up that little girl's legs and she's wearing like the dress.
Oh gosh, yeah, that's another scene where I was thinking, okay, is this movie, are these going to be dream sequences? Or it was so just almost gratuitously lush at moments. The little girl's blue dress, yeah.
Well, what freaked me, you know, what freaked me out, because I thought I was getting, okay, this is present, this is past. I was getting the visual grammar of the film. And it looked, I was trying to suss out, okay, this is when we're going into the past or a flashback, this is the way the film looks. And then you have that scene where he's sitting on the toilet reading and looking out the window and seeing the neighbor kids looking for coins. And then, and I thought that was all flashback.
Yeah.
And then she sees him and he moves out of the way. And then I was totally thrown and realized, well, I don't know where it is. And I think a lot of it is just sort of realizing that this is him saying goodbye to the world. So a lot of these sensual moments are him taking them in this last time. I don't think this is constant for him.
Right.
It's a terrible place for a window in your bathroom. It's like a space lovable by the toilet.
Can I just say can I have that house?
God, no kidding. Wow. Yeah.
Lord.
Well, so Jim was an architect, I think they point out at one point.
Did he make the house?
Well, he already had – that guy already – I mean, George already lived there. I mean, he was clearly – he was – they Jim met –
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah, you're right. Did I make that up about Jim being an architect then?
No, you're right. He says it to Kenny.
Did you guys recognize Kenny, by the way? Do you guys know who that was?
No.
It was about a boy.
Yeah, it was the little kid from About a Boy with those eyes.
And
holy
Jim
cow.
Was
Ozymandias, yeah, from Watchmen. Dingus, do you know where else we've seen Nicholas Holt, though, who played Kenny?
No, but somebody from this worked on About a Boy, Chris White.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Chris White's produced A Single Man.
I have no idea where Kenny
so,
comes from. Besides
Nicholas Holt also, I think he's now setting himself up to be typecast as sort of older man, gay bait. He was Nicolas Cage's oldest son in Weatherman, where there's also where he gets picked up by his it might be like a rehab counselor or something who encourages him, who loans him a camera and takes topless pictures of him, and Nicolas Cage eventually tracks the guy down and punches him. But do you remember him from Weatherman, Dingus?
I don't at all. I mean, the only picture I have is of the daughter.
Okay. And also, Dingus, you often wear an Angora sweater like Kenny was wearing.
Uh-huh.
I'm wearing it right now, as a matter of fact, so put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Huh.
I
in front of your kids, they let you let them see you wear that?
We have matching ones.
Oh. Are they daughters?
They will be.
When you're through with them.
I could not get over that sweater. I was like, I guess in 1962, of course, people dressed differently. But I didn't have a problem with people being gay in the movie. I just had a problem with anybody wearing that Angora sweater who's a dude. It's like,
and he had a hot girlfriend.
Yeah, how about that? Again, I was thinking, okay, wow, these were going to be him imagining himself when he was younger with Julianne Moore. But that didn't pan out.
I really like that line where Colin Firth asks Kenny if he slept with Lori or what's her name. And he goes, oh, we slept together once. And he goes, why only once? And Kenny goes, I didn't say only once.
So let me ask
good.
The two of you then. What do you think? what do you think is the relationship, or what do you think we're supposed to take from the relationship of Kenny and George? Kelly, what do you think?
Well, he's just like Kenny's the younger love. He's like a younger Jim, but missing that same essential quality kind of thing. Like his last goodbye. I mean, Kenny makes himself so available to him. George doesn't really have to do anything. Like Kenny basically stalks him all the way to the pencil eraser store or pencil sharpener store and gives him one. So Kenny represents good luck. That's what I got out of it. I don't know. I was pretending they were lesbians the whole movie. So I had a totally different concept. And Kenny was the Scarlett Johansson lesbian, and Colin Firth was the Julianne Moore. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, I was just curious what you guys thought. What do you think, Tom?
I wasn't sure what to make of it, and I don't...
Kenny was such an enigmatic figure. It was a little hard to... for me to quite pigeonhole him, as it were.
And I'm not sure, too, what to make of how sexualized the relationship was supposed to be. Like, I don't... In movie language, it seems like they didn't sleep together. But obviously...
But they could have.
They could have, and I'm assuming that Nicholas Holt looks totally hot to, like, a gay guy. I mean, I look at him, and I'm like, wow, that's a beautiful guy. If I was gay, any gay man would...
You totally hit that.
Right, yeah. So I'm not clear, too, on how sexualized Colin Firth felt towards him, or how much of it was this sort of older protector feeling. Are we supposed to take from this, if you fall in love and you lose the person that you cared about, then just meet someone young and hot and you'll get over your feelings of suicide? You know, I don't think that's where it was going, but watching it, that's what I was thinking at times. Like, okay, well, is he just meeting his replacement for Jim? What is he getting out of his relationship with Kenny? What's going on here? Where is this going to go?
I saw it as a Wonder Boys-esque relationship between Michael Douglas and Tobey Maguire. He's taking him under his wing.
So but
Kenny was the instigator for so much. I guess that analogy doesn't really apply.
Right.
I mean, Kenny really glommed onto him.
And that's why, you know, calling, I think, Dingus, you were saying, like, a guardian angel. Like, I really think that's kind of a lot of what was going on there was Kenny was just this young, precocious, just very sensitive, aware kid who was worried about his professor and who wanted to do whatever he could, including, I presume, offering himself sexually to help his professor, this man who he respected and admired.
And I guess the thing that turned him that day was... George's speech in class.
Yes, right.
So heartfelt that Kenny went, wait, he's either thinking of killing himself or there's something about today. Today is
Well, uncharacteristic. He says to George at one point, you just let us out of line. Yeah, why don't you ever talk to us like that? Yeah. All right, Dingus, it's your turn. What did you think of their relationship?
Yeah, Mr. Questions.
Yeah.
Mr.
I'm
Questions.
I'll hoist you on your own petard now.
Nicely done. I go with what I already said. Next question. No,
you just admired his sweater.
I loved his sweater, and I want to know where I can pick one of those up. I can't believe I can't just click on that somewhere.
But in Vermilion.
Well, I think if it's just – I think it's not about let me just find a younger version, because he has that opportunity outside the liquor store in that fascinating scene with the young guy out there where George says, today is kind of a serious day for me. And the guy's kind of trying to tell him, well, when my mother said, when you lose your lover, it's just an opportunity for another lover to come along. I mean, he says it more gently and romantically than I just
and
said
in
it,
Spanish.
But it's sort of a
line. Yeah.
And in beautiful exactly. You're better than James Dean, as he says.
Yeah.
So if that was all he wanted, that's clearly not what he wanted. It's moving on from that. And so there's this fascinating thing that goes on when they're back at George's house, and George says to him, we need to get you out of those wet clothes. And there's this, and as Kenny undresses, there's this feeling of are we going to play the parts that we would play in this situation, or are we going to be real to what's actually going on in this situation? And when you get to a certain level, do we have to keep playing the part or not? And he takes off his underwear and they just look at each other, and then Kenny goes to take a shower. And so it's just, I don't think George can have those feelings for somebody, because he is so grief stricken and so in love that he just wants to leave this world. And Kenny is talking about wanting to leave the present. I want to leave the present. I just, all I care about is leaving the present. And George is talking about the future equals death. So they're sort of trying to find for each other, how do we meet each other's needs here, so that Kenny can leave the present and George can go to the future. And I think Kenny, I said guardian angel, and I don't mean that in a mystical way. I think Kenny deliberately goes after him because he sees him cleaning out his desk, and he had gone to find out his address before all of this.
Right.
So it happened even before
the speech. That's true.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't think about that till just now. So I don't know. I mean,
so he was stalking him all along. The guardian angel, I mean.
Well, I was nervous about that because he was a drug dealer, that he was just going to try to take George. But
it's a gay neighborhood and he knows the address. Like, oh, yeah, you must live there.
Well, it's not a gay neighborhood or a gayborhood, because the father across the across the street says he's lighting his loafers and the kid keeps trying
to shoot
him.
A gay neighborhood because the kid's gay and lighting his loafers. But not whole family's gay. It's a gay family.
Well, the older brother is, but the younger kid who keeps shooting people.
Who gets peed on. How about that scene? There was
That's
there
awesome.
Was one fantasy scene.
That took me back.
Good lord. And then the 1-2-3 theme comes in.
No, wait. We're not done yet.
We're not.
My favorite scene is the sleeping bag scene, where he's trying to find a way to kill himself without making a mess on the sheets.
That's kind of the reveal, too, isn't it? Where you finally realize what he's going to do.
Well, you suspect until then.
Well, here's where I think it's...
They turn it into a John Landis movie for a couple minutes.
I'm glad you brought that up. But, Tom, you go ahead, and then I want to deal with this, too.
Well, it is a reveal, because if it was just going to be... As you're watching the movie, you're wondering, okay, what's this guy going to do? Did you guys see 7 Pounds, by the way, that thing with Will Smith?
No.
Okay, well, it has a similar tease, where this guy is made, he's going to do something dire, and the movie is about it unfolds what it is he's going to do, and it ends up being ridiculous. But so it's the same thing. He pulls the gun out, and that's that right there. It's okay, something serious. But the fact that he takes the gun with him to work is a tease, because I'm thinking this is going to be about, you know, a siege, or he's going to take a hostage, or he's going to kill someone. But he's really just taking the guns to get the right size bullets.
Right.
And so once he's got the bullets and he goes back home with the gun and does that, it's like, okay, it's only suicide. He's not going to flip out and kill people. So Dingus, yeah, what did you think that scene where he's trying the different angles with the pillow and whatnot? What did that do for you? You wanted to talk about that?
Well, I was so thrown off by the tone there, and my theater was pretty full of people, and they were laughing.
Oh God,
you know. And there was a little bit of nervous laughter, and there was a little bit of when he gets the sleeping bag, when he slumps down with all the pillows, when he falls down in the shower, and he's doing all that stuff, and I just sort of started to feel uneasy. Is the film losing its tone? But I think Tom Ford knows what he's doing there, because I've seen I don't know if you guys remember Lethal Weapon.
How dare you? How dare you?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but this is an example of that used.
Another hilarious suicide attempt scene, like the one from Lethal Weapon.
Do you remember the suicide attempt scene?
Like Mel Gibson's acting. That's his Oscar reel moment.
Yeah, he has long hair too.
Do you remember him putting a gun in his mouth and looking at the picture of his wife and saying, "Oh, I miss you, Victoria Lynn," and it's this whole like ridiculous. Yeah. I'm gonna and you know. Mel Gibson's not going to shoot himself, and it's totally melodramatic, and it's over the top, and it's just suicide as like bleh, you know, we're just going to use suicide as a plot point.
Well, it's set up for the payoff of his eyes going all buggy for the rest of the movie.
Well, and this movie doesn't do that. This movie, it's sort of like the filmmaker knows where we're going to go, and he's not being. I don't think he's being campy. Not to use a pun here. Are you going camping, sir? Not to use a pun with the sleeping bag, but he's he's sort of lightening things a little bit to let us know that this isn't where we're going yet, but anything could happen here. And so I sort of appreciated it, although at first I was a little bit nervous about the tone, but that might have been just the fact that everybody in the theater was laughing.
Yeah, I was uncomfortable with that sequence, too, because it was a little too lighthearted and didn't work for me. But I think what they were going for was this sense of him just being so meticulous and wanting everything just so. I think it was the same tone as him, and I loved this, one of maybe my favorite quote from the movie. This is a Windsor suit, underlining Windsor.
No, it's not. It's a Windsor knot, actually.
What?
The tie.
Oh.
The note is about tying the tie in a Windsor.
I couldn't read that note.
Yeah, his handwriting was terrible. But other than that, it seemed like he was very meticulous.
You notice he put the note right on top of the tie. He wants them to tie it in a Windsor.
Oh, for his funeral. Nice. Okay, thank you, Dingus. You understood that way better than me. Well done.
And he read it.
I was stuck trying to translate Windsor. What is that word? So I didn't get to not. But it was the same kind of thing. I think that's what they were going for, is that he even wants his body to be discovered in a very particular way.
He wants them to use the tie that'll have blood all over it because he didn't take it off.
And so he must have put all that stuff up, because I thought, too, when he shows up with Kenny, there was going to be stuff laid out everywhere with notes.
There was. It was still there.
Please watch the windows.
And Kenny didn't.
No, that stuff was still there because he goes and gets the letters and puts them in the fireplace, and then Kenny finds the gun.
Please burn this letter. I also got from that scene that he answered the phone at the end of it, and like that's what prevents him from finally pulling the trigger, which made me think that if you feel the need to answer the phone when you're about to kill yourself, your heart's not actually in time. Because I don't even answer my phone when I'm not trying to kill myself, which is like 3 hours of the day.
All right.
Well, he has been constantly not answering the phone, though. I mean, there's this thing in the morning where the phone's constantly ringing and he's not answering it.
Right. So the fact that he answers it then means, I can't do this yet. I got to go see Julianne one last time.
Were you guys okay with the music?
Oh yeah, I loved it.
I love that kind of like melodramatic, like string music. That stuff totally worked for me.
Do you know anything about the? Did you notice anything about the music? By the way,
fellow named Stephen Trask, maybe.
Well, yeah, it says music consultant Stephen Trask, so you know who that is.
The guy that did the lyrics and the music for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. He's done a lot of movies, though. Actually, he's a regular movie guy. I do know who he is.
He also did Station Agent, by the way.
Ah, very good. I don't remember music in that. But he wasn't the composer, by the way. They had him as music consultant.
Who was the composer?
There were two different names for the composer, and all I remember is that one of them was Japanese.
The guy who did the original music was named Abel Korzyniowski, but I don't know him from anything. But
that's not Japanese.
He had a Japanese sidekick or something. I don't know. But I loved that music. I love that sort of melodramatic string music. That stuff really works for me.
Well, some of the music, and at least the last thing that was listed in the credits, was by Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. There was a Bernard Herrmann credit. I don't remember what that was for, though.
I don't know either. It was called Scene d'Amour, and I don't know what it was used for. But
what's this got to do with the Munsters?
Oh, God. Oh, Kelly Wand. So real quick, let's talk, too, about – I just want to say here and now on this podcast, I liked Colin Firth way before you guys did. So this was so – I just loved seeing him doing this part.
From
so,
what? Velma?
Here you go. You guys have not seen a movie called Geneva, I bet. I'll bet you dollars to donuts. It's a Michael Winterbottom movie, which is very similar to A Single Man, in that he plays a widower raising two daughters while he's on a sabbatical in Genoa. But it takes advantage of – he's got this great, you know, these soulful brown eyes and this sort of forlorn look to him that – I didn't remember this. Did you guys realize he was the cuckolded husband in an English Patient?
Hello, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys did remember that? All right. Whatever.
Yeah, totally.
Shut up. He's the guy who flew the – he's like, hey, Kristen Scott Thomas, get in the airplane. I'm going to fly it into the ground. That was him.
Oh, right.
He almost runs over
that
David
iconic Cole. Line.
Yeah. But also, you know, I think he's more often the sort of Mr. Darcy, the like stuffed shirt fellow, like in Bridget Jones' Diary. You know, he's the safe but reliable choice. That's, you know, she's got to choose between bad boy Hugh Jackman. What's that dude's name? Hugh O'Connor.
Hugh Hefner.
What the heck? Why can't I think of his name?
Hugh Laurie.
No.
Damn. Shut up.
Anyway.
Hugh Grant.
Right, that guy. Whereas he's the stuffed shirt alternative.
He was also the dad in that Amanda Bynes movie that Tom said was the one he'd take to a desert island.
Amanda. And you loved him in Love Actually.
Oh,
you?
God, you would bring that up, wouldn't you?
Hey, do you guys remember a movie called Apartment Zero?
Oh, that was him. Oh, my God, of course. And he was gay in that, too. I totally forgot about that.
Well, that's where I started liking him, so suck it.
Yeah, but you only saw that after I told you to see it, so suck it back.
Tom, you've played a gay man on national television.
One, two, three, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between. Counting one, two, three, feet apart and they're free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves
Holden. How you cut that off with Britney Spears is the
best ever.
This week's 3x3. So brought to you by Kelly Wand. Kelly, why don't you tell us what you got for us for 3x3 this week?
Oh, yeah. What? I have to explain what we're doing?
Everyone knows. So every week we pick three movies that fit the criteria. Someone has come up with a list.
I don't have to explain that part yet.
Right. So tell us what our list is for this week, Kelly Wand. What do you got?
Oh, you didn't think I could handle the other, just explaining the general definition of 3x3?
It seems to have thrown...
You're correct. This week's 3x3 topic that I think everyone really enjoyed coming up with was the three best uses of an amputated limb, including heads and or dicks.
Mm-hmm. Or extremities.
Oh, extremities, sorry. I get the 6 of 1. I don't know. So who gets to go first? Me? Because I don't want to steal Dingus's before he does it.
I think Dingus and I might have some overlap. I carefully tried to work around it. We'll see how it goes.
You can't pick the list and then go first? Is that the
way? That's the thing, is you go last. Dingus goes first because he's got next week's list. And then I go, Kelly Wand, you're last, I'm afraid.
Ruined.
Don't worry. The funny thing is, this is like playing some sort of card game where I tried so hard to think of what you guys wouldn't think, and you probably did the same thing that we probably wound up thinking the same stuff. All right. And you have this whole raft of obvious ones that you're trying to avoid, but my number three is clearly an obvious one, so I'm going to go with that. You ready?
Rock and roll.
All right, it's a 1981 film called Clash of the Titans.
Yay! That's not on my list, so I'm happy.
If Edith Hamilton were here, it would be on her list.
That's a good choice. I like your choice, Dennis. I wouldn't think of it.
Well, it's because of Edith Hamilton. Obviously, for those who have not seen Clash of the Titans in 20 years, it's using Medusa's head to turn the Kraken into stone. But it's
wait, what?
Oh, I thought you were talking about Bubo getting castrated.
No, I'm talking about Medusa.
Oh,
talking about the use of Medusa's head, obviously, I guess this came out in 1981. I was about 13, and so not too long before this, I was in sixth grade, and we studied mythology, and I was nuts about mythology, so I loved this movie. And even more than the actual use of Medusa's head, what sticks in my memory is him using his shield as a mirror to see her and then to decapitate her. So Clash of the Titans, next.
Very good. So I like, Dingus, what you're doing. I was worried, because of the way Kelly worded it, the best uses of a severed head, limb, or extremity, that you guys are just going to come up with stuff where one of those things appeared in the movie. You know, like Jaws, where Ben Gardner's head rolls out of the boat. You know, nobody's using the head. It just shows up. So what
wasn't
I did...
just his head in Jaws, wasn't it? Wasn't Ben Gardner's whole body?
No, it's just his head. The shark's eating his body. You know, Hooper goes down and he's prying the tooth out of the boat, and the head comes rolling out.
You go in the water, shark goes in the water.
Ben Gardner, that's a later scene. You know, Ben Gardner's the guy who Right, and he has a couple of lines where there's guys like throwing dynamite in the water during the shark hunt. But anyway, so that's an instance. There are plenty of these where there happens to be a severed head, but nobody is using it. And because of the way you phrased it, Kelly, I thought of things where items were actually used, like Dingus did with the Medusa's head. So my, let's see, which one do I want to put? This is the one I thought you were going to take, Dingus, and I think you might still take it, so I'm hoping to preempt you. A crucial part of a horror movie, a general type of horror movie, is showing the progression of a character, this sort of descent into hell. And a lot of times this descent involves messing up the character. You know, the character has to get all dirty and mucky and has to go from a guy in a suit or whatever to somebody who's all like torn and bloody and battered and wielding a chainsaw. You know, it's this, it's the character totally is, it gets a makeover. So this is a very small, low budget horror movie called Black Water about people who are stalked by a crocodile in Australia. And one of the characters is this young woman who's not outdoorsy at all, and she ends up being the heroine. And at the end of the movie, when it's down to her and the crocodile, she has been dragged to the crocodile to this mound where the crocodile keeps its victims, and she gets a gun. But I think her fingers are broken or something. She can't use the gun correctly. She's covered in mud. She's screaming. She's frantic. And she takes the severed arm of one of the crocodile's victims to beat the thing back. And it's just this classic instance of that horror movie arc where she's gone from this very well-kept, well-put-together young girl to this screaming, she's like a demon or something with a severed arm and the gun and just covered in mud. So my number three pick is Blackwater.
I am so happy that you picked that.
Was that one you were thinking of? Because I was thinking that maybe you would preempt me on that.
No, but I was obsessed this week with thinking of, because when Kelly introduced this last week, you said, what are you thinking of?
Yeah.
You don't get to use this one. And so I was obsessed with thinking of, what does he think I'm thinking? And I finally came up with Blackwater, and I decided to avoid it because, but I nailed at least what you were going for.
Good.
Nicely done.
So, all right. So that's my use of a severed arm in Blackwater. Kelly Wand, what's your number three?
I got to redo my list because I thought I meant the other stuff you said we weren't doing. So I just have like amputations and not cool uses of them.
So let's see. Reservoir Dogs. Is that?
Hey,
what
he
gets
talks
cut off
in
that?
He talks into the ear.
Yeah, that's true. I guess he does use it.
Believe me, that was on my long list.
Understanding, Kelly, you came up with the list. You can do whatever you like with it. What was your number three?
My number three was a small 1980 film called Empire Strikes Back.
Wait, hold on. I don't know what you're talking about. Is that a Kurosawa film?
I think it's actually just called Empire Strikes Back. Or it might actually be called Star Empire Strikes Back Wars, based on a logo.
Right, are you sure it's not An Empire Strikes Back?
It's Amakin Strikes Back.
All right, go ahead, Kelly Wand.
The reason it was good was because the first time, it's hard to go back that far in your memory, but the first time you saw Empire Strikes Back, you didn't actually know that they could make bionic hands.
Ah.
So when you see Darth Vader cut Luke's hand off, you go, oh, he just maimed his son for life and he never can fight again. And he does it kind of with a sort of casual irritation. You go, you don't mean anything. You can't do it.
And it also, it plays into this idea of making Luke more like Darth Vader, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I like that one, Kelly Wand. Although nobody uses the severed hand, so you can't use it for this list.
Well, we think, someone could have used it once it fell. But
like an Ugnaught or something down in Cloud City found it.
Yeah. But someone down on the planet got a free lightsaber and a hand. guys.
Okay, good.
Free lightsaber and a hand.
Plus, also, it makes the title make sense. Like, the Empire really is striking back. It's like cutting off a hand. That's striking back.
That's a very palpable hit.
It's a literal.
By the way, that is my third Hamlet reference in this podcast. I just want you all to know.
Say it again.
Oh, I've only tracked two.
A very palpable hit. The readiness is all. What was my second one?
Well, at the end, you can say the rest is silence.
Oh, and hoist by your own petard.
All right.
So that doesn't count.
What are you talking about? How dare you?
Neither a borrower nor a lender be, Tom.
See, you're just gratuitously making up stuff, though. Mine have all been in context. All right, Dingus, what's your number two use of a severed extremity, head, or penis in a movie?
All right, I'm going to do my
my thing where I give you guys a quote. How about
okay,
that?
Good, good. I'm ready. I'm good at this game. Kelly, one, ready? Ready? Yeah, let's go.
Did I just cut off your finger?
Because this is the other one I thought you were going to pick, and I didn't pick because it was so pedestrian.
Scarface.
No, it's not Scarface.
Goodfellas. Casino.
No.
Is
you
it,
know what?
Is it Sharky's Machine?
Is the line spoken to Robert Downey Jr.?
Indeed it is. Very nice.
So I was going to pick this one. I was like, that's too
easy.
Oh,
yeah.
This is the other one besides Blackwater that I thought you would choose, Dingus. So I'm glad you didn't disappoint us. So go ahead. Explain what it is, because Kelly Wand may not have seen it.
No, I think he's wrong. It's very surprising. Okay.
I'll do another quote. Who taught you math?
You know what else is kind of nuts? Is that you cut off my finger. And then it's this great, it's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Sorry for those of you who aren't on this podcast. It's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang from 2005, and it's that his finger gets cut off, and again, and then a dog eats it. So I think that there's a great way that the amputation is used again and again in the movie.
Hey, they didn't use it. Oh, I guess the dog used it.
It definitely got used, yeah. And it's an example of a permanent mutilation being played to great effect for laughs. Quite interesting.
And just so you know, the dog actually ate a Vienna sausage, not a finger.
Whew. Man, I was right about that. Good.
How did he get a Vienna sausage on the end of his hand?
Well, that's the thing. A lot of people don't know that about Robert Downey Jr. One of the things that was his problem is that he has Vienna sausages for fingers.
Aha, good one.
And also for...
Whoa. My number two. We'll move on. Also a severed finger, but the severed finger is used by aliens from another planet.
Is also a severed finger another Hamlet reference?
That's actually from Coriolanus. These aliens from another planet, they have
referenced.
Greater gravity on their planet. So they come to Earth to shrink down dead bodies.
And yay!
Kelly Wan, this is not interrupt Tom and tell Spock what the movie is before he's finished. So yes.
Kelly the blurt wand.
So yes, in Phantasm, severed finger mutates into a bug which terrorizes the boy and his brother. And I remember, and it had this great, as a kid seeing that movie, that was one of, Kelly Wand, before you were wanting to know the first R-rated movie, that was the first, I think, breast I'd ever seen in a movie. Is a little boy who lived down the street from me, his parents would be gone, and they had this newfangled VCR thing, and he had a movie on it called Phantasm. And I remember seeing that and having my young mind blown for a couple of reasons, one of which was there's a naked breast early in the movie.
I don't remember a breast in that movie.
It's weird because it's intercut with Angus Scrimm. Like it's Angus Scrimm sizes himself as a naked girl, so there's this naked girl, but then it does this weird flashing sequence where the naked girl turns into Angus Scrimm and back and forth. And
so it's erotic in a Requiem for a Dream sense.
I'd go with that.
Do you remember how they get rid of the finger?
So they put it in a garbage disposal. That whole sequence has this great fever dream quality where he's running from the tall man, he closes the door on him and he thinks he's safe, and then he hears the finger, it's the hands flopping around in the door, and he cuts his fingers off and he puts one in his pocket because he wants it to be proof to his brother that there's something weird going on. And then after he brings the finger home, it turns into this bug, and they fight the bug, and they cram it down a garbage disposal. And Don Coscarelli, by the way, who directed Phantasm, seems to like this idea of people fighting a little bug, because he did the same thing. What was the Elvis versus the Mummy movie?
Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep, right. They had the same gimmick in Bubba Hotep, where they fight an ancient Egyptian scarab. But that was all. Began with a finger. So that's my number two, is the finger morphing into a bug in Phantasm. Kelly Wand, what is your number two? Go ahead.
Did Dingus do his number two?
Oh, right. Dingus, what is your number two? I forgot. I was going to
say. Okay. My number two, again, is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Oh, yeah. He loses two fingers. That's right.
That's right. He loses it again.
An eye. Yeah. Okay. Good.
I've done number three and number two. Your turn, Kelly, for number two.
All right. My number two, since I ruined Tom's, I really apologize for that.
Well, make us guess, and I'm going to see if I can figure it out before you say the name of the
You know what? That makes it more of a game.
Go for it.
All right. So I was just trying to enliven things by ruining your whole show.
No, well, Dingus,
listeners will appreciate it.
Dingus makes us guests, so Dingus sort of set that whole thing up. So you were playing within the context of the rules. That's fine.
Well, it's only fun if I miss it, if I get it wrong.
Well, I've got one for my number one. I'm going to make you guys guess, and I guarantee you will probably. Well, I don't know. So go ahead.
You won't get this one, but you'll get my number one. Okay, my number two is a scene where it was
Spartacus.
Also... Hey, that is annoying. I was violent, even more profusely. 1980s horror movie. That's your hint. It involves homeless people playing hot potato with a bum's severed penis after a monster has bitten it off.
Is it?
Name it.
Prince of Darkness?
Breakfast Club.
No. Breakfast. Those are both homeless people movies. Yes.
I don't think I've seen it.
Oh,
a bum's severed penis. Wow.
Ironweed.
Why would they cut the dude's wiener off in a horror movie? Why is the?
Because a monster bit it off. They didn't cut it off.
Monster.
They found it, and then that's their reaction to it. He wants to get it reattached, and they playfully keep him from getting his.
And it's a monster that attacks homeless people. Is it Blood Beach?
No.
Hmm. Who's in? Is anyone famous in this horror movie?
Klaus Kinski. Just kidding.
I'm not googling it. You are now googling it, Kelly Wand. You're busted.
You're googling your own. Collection.
I don't think I've seen this, Kelly Wand.
Mike Lackey plays Fred in it. Spoiler alert.
I don't think I know this horror movie.
Oh, it's a movie called Street Trash.
That sounds obscure.
No, Street Trash.
And what's the monster? Is it like a werewolf kind of thing, or what's going on here?
There's like it's like Leviathan, that Peter Weller submarine movie where there's like evil liquor called Viper. And it turns the hobos into monsters, and one of the monsters bites a penis off.
Okay, good.
There's also an exploding fat man in it.
Do you recommend Street Trash, or this is just you're just recalling this weird scene that made an impression on you?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay. All right, that's an interesting one. Good. I always enjoy hearing about movies I've never seen. Dingus, what is your number one?
All right, let me do a big Kelly Wand sigh first. My number one is a total cheat, and I apologize in advance.
Uh-oh.
It's a 1991 film called Barton Fink.
I'm hanging up. Goodbye. I'm done with this podcast. You're a jerk.
I hate this podcast.
You stole my number one.
No,
I
didn't.
You're fired.
Really?
Yeah, you're fired.
Just say seven.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
It's a head in a box.
My whole thing was going to say, yeah, it features the line, what's in the box? And there's a head in a box. Oh, God.
I didn't do it.
You still could have done that, Tom. Sorry. I had no idea. I thought I would be totally ostracized for being
this. How do I hang up on Dingus? Where do I cut him off of the phone?
Just hit D. Oh, Control D.
God, you're such a jerk.
See, you have to actually see the extremity. So I should have mentioned that when I came
up with this. Disqualified.
Well, that's why That's why I thought you guys would get rid of me. And this might be our first overlap, if you're being honest, Tom.
I am being honest. You're such a jerk. Being honest about that, too, that you're a jerk.
No, we had an overlap last week. I forget what it was.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, we did.
Only
there was one.
No.
We did. It was me and someone.
No, this is our first overlap.
No, you're wrong.
On first.
Bet you.
So, Kelly Wand, what's your name again? You're the jerk who steals my 3x3 entries. Explain to us the use of a head, because well, go ahead. What do you got for me? Interesting.
I wasn't talking about the head at all. I was talking about the penis that the homeless people throw around. And Steve Buscemi catches it and takes it under the hotel.
Yes.
No, you know what I'm talking about. It's the box that Barton carries around, and it's got it. I've said this before. The sound design on this film is one of my favorite sound designs ever. And the sound of that, whatever's in the box rolling around, and you don't know for sure what's in the box.
Yeah, you do.
And as Kelly has clearly said, it has not. It's not an extremity or a head or a penis that we've seen, but it's just this got this thunk, and it's just. I loved
I loved the way that box is used. The sense of dread. This is one of the best examples of dread, which rhymes with head, that I can think of.
See, that's for the three uses of a box in a movie.
So yeah, how does someone, if this is your number one pick, Mr. Smart Guy, how does someone use this head? What role does it serve?
He uses it to hit it on that chick at the beach at the end. She goes, he must be rich because he's got a little box next to him.
She does say to him what's in the box. I watched it again because I wanted to be clear on this, and I bet you didn't do that, Dinkus. So,
no, I didn't. I watched Brokeback Mountain instead.
I probably have a little bit more insight into the issue than you do on this because you're probably just going on vague recollections, whereas I can speak very explicitly about this head in the box. The girl does say to him what's in the box, which is awesome because, you know, 4 years later, however many later, Seven came along. Brad Pitt asks the same thing, and the answer is the same answer. Do you remember whose head is in there, what sort of dramatic role it serves in the movie, and we'll go ahead. Do you remember more specifics? Because I wanted to go back and watch it before I picked this for my number one slot as well. I wanted to go back and watch it to get more specifics on what was going on there. Do you remember many of those?
No, I certainly don't. I just remember the impressions of the sound,
right,
of him carrying it with him where he went, of John Goodman saying, I went back to visit your family, and him flashing back to that, and then him being on the beach. So I'm pleased that you went back to see it, and you can give us more details.
Because I wanted to...
Judy Davis's head, am I wrong?
Yeah, exactly. I was specific, because I was thinking, because there is the suggestion that John Goodman, Madman Munt, has murdered... Barton Fink's family. And so I was thinking, well, is that his family's head in there? Who is it? But clearly what happens is Madman Munt, John Goodman, has murdered Judy Davis while she's in bed with Barton Fink, and he puts her head in a box and tells him, these are some of my personal effects, I want you to watch them. And then later on, shortly thereafter, you find out in that great scene with the fast-talking detectives, the two guys, you find out that John Goodman is, in fact, a murderer who kills people with a shotgun and then keeps their heads as a trophy. So it's right after John Goodman has disposed of Judy Davis's body to protect Barton Fink that he brings in this box and he says, there's something in here, I want you to take care of it. These are worldly possessions that mean a lot to me. And in the end, after the Hotel Earl is burning down, the very last thing John Goodman says before he goes back into his own room is, oh, I lied about what was in the box. So I think it's clear that he's confessing that, yes, that's Judy Davis's head in there. So, but the role that it plays in the movie.
Wait, hold on.
Okay.
I don't remember. I remember Barton Fink waking up next to Judy Davis.
Right.
And that whole blood scene, yep, and that she's dead. I don't remember anything about where her body goes.
So he calls John Goodman, who's his neighbor. Yeah. And he says, I've done something terrible. Will you wait with me while I call the police? You know, and I didn't do this. I don't know how it happened. So John Goodman snaps him into shape, and he's like, we're not going to tell the police about this. I'll take care of it. You sit here in the bathroom.
Oh.
And he puts – and John Goodman basically blacks out, and there's this awesome sequence where John Turturro blacks out.
Oh,
where,
okay,
John,
yeah,
Goodman is bringing him to by slapping him, like, really hard across,
right,
the face. So John Goodman, you see him bundle the body up in the blankets, and there's this great thing, because you can't really do this in a movie. There's a great thing where he's walking out with the body, and there's an arm sticking out, so there's obviously somebody in there, and he bangs its head into a door. Because,
right,
if you've got a real person, you can't, like, step on their head or necessarily bang them into...
That's why he put it in the box, so it wouldn't keep getting in the way.
There you go. So it's John Goodman has clearly disposed of Judy Davis's body, and the cops later tell Barton Fink, we found this woman, and they describe her, except she didn't have a head. You know, we found this body. We think this is his latest victim. Have you ever seen Munt with someone who matches this description? So that's his victim. So, but the role that it plays in the movie is that John Turturro, you know, Barton Fink can't work. He's got something, you know, so many things are going wrong, and he's wanting to do different kinds of stories, and the whole studio system he's not really fitting in with. The catalyst is after this terrible thing happens and he finds out that William Faulkner is a fraud and he sleeps with his assistant, with Judy Davis, and then she gets murdered and the body's disposed of, and then John Goodman goes out of town and he feels alone and confused. John Goodman gives him the box, he puts the box on his desk, and then he immediately sits down and writes what he thinks is his greatest work.
Right.
So it's sort of like this, all that, you know, being sort of having committed this terrible crime, had sort of sunk to the depths and having a murder and his this person he looked up to exposed as a fraud. And this head sitting on this desk with him does something, you know, whatever's going on to unlock this work of genius that he creates that, of course, the studio wants nothing to do with when the movie's over.
Even dead, she's an amazing muse.
Exactly.
But it's also just the same. It's just very the same much. It's much the same thing he's already written, isn't it?
Well, you know, he calls. There's a scene where he calls his agent. And he says, you know, this is the greatest thing I've ever done. It's unlike, you know, it's the same kind of thing he wants to write, where it's not just it's not just Hollywood stuff. It's not a script.
It's a wrestler wrestling with his soul.
Right, right. I think it's Michael Lerner calls it fruity stuff about suffering. You know, you've written a fruity story about suffering, which.
but the last line is almost the exact same last line as in the hit play at the beginning, right?
Oh, you know what? You'll
be hearing from this kid again.
Oh, right, right. And I don't mean a postcard. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
So, yeah, Judy Davis's severed head is sort of his muse.
The Coens said they're going to make a sequel to that, but they're waiting for John Turturro to get old enough for him to play. Pardon me. Again.
That is an amazing scene, though, by the way, where, you know, I'll show you the life of the mind. God, that's an amazing bit of work. All right, well, we don't have to do my number one because Dingus stole it from me.
Well, we both just did it. It was a collaboration. And by the way, that performance by John Goodman, one of my favorite performances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's always good in a Coen Brothers movie. He hasn't been in one in a while, though, has he? Maybe they broke up.
Yeah, could be. All right, Kelly, well, that's a tough act to follow. What do you got for us? Can I guess? Can we guess what you've picked?
Yeah, I'll say what's going on, and I predict actually you do guess it.
Blue Velvet, Wolf Creek. Road Warrior. Big Lebowski. Big Lebowski.
Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs.
Okay, what do you got? Make us guess.
It's a scene where a living Pugless decapitated snap. Head. No, close.
Reanimator.
Yeah.
Godfather. Godfather. Godfather.
I don't think Dingus has seen
Godfather 1. Godfather 2.
Dingus hasn't seen it, so explain Reanimator to Dingus.
Children of Men. Total Recall.
Conversation. Tsardas.
The God. Young Frankenstein.
In Lonely Place. Birth of a Nation. Mona Lisa. Bible.
Big Lebowski.
Big Bang. Oh. It's a scene where a professor's head has been reanimated and his body is holding it in his hand so he can orally rape this beautiful young blonde girl that he had a thing for when he was alive. And she's, like, strapped to a metal table because he's about to cut her up or something.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Gordon. That's Stuart Gordon for you in a nutshell right there.
Free robot jocks.
Good Lord.
Yeah, that is kind of a famous scene. That one didn't even occur to me, but well done, Kelly Wand.
Did you see Bride of Reanimator?
Probably. You know what? I've seen From Beyond. From Beyond, I'm thinking of. I may not. Was that Stuart Gordon?
Yeah, that was Stuart Gordon.
Bride of Reanimator. You know what? Maybe I haven't seen that. Does it have Jeffrey Combs in it?
Yeah, someone else plays the other guy, but it opens and they're in like a Mexican Revolution or an El Salvadoran Revolution or something, and they're like harvesting bodies from that, and testing it. So he's learned nothing from his experiences in the first movie.
And is it terrible?
It opens good, and then it's kind of boring compared to the first one. First one's good times.
Stuart Gordon, though, by the way, has really come around. Did you manage to see Stuck?
No, I wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, that was because Stuart Gordon was doing so much junk for so long. Stuck is really good.
What's the premise of Stuck?
Stuck is based on an actual, based on a true story. So there's an actual account in San Francisco where a woman hit a homeless person and he was lodged in the windshield and she freaked out, you know, thought she'd killed him, parked the car in the garage and just left it alone there. She had been at a party, I think, and might have been drunk. And the guy lived for a couple of days and then eventually died, and she refused to help him. So Stuck is a dramatization. It's sort of based loosely on the story, where Mina Suvari plays somebody who ironically helps old people in a rest home. She hits Jeffrey Rush, who's a down on his luck, and yeah, he's homeless too. And it's about him being stuck in the windshield while she parks it in the car and eventually tries to get rid of his body, but he's not dead yet. It's a lot kind of like Misery, where the protagonist is someone who's crippled and the murderer is an unlikely woman. So, yeah. So, Stuart Gordon, and that's his last movie.
His next movie is House of Reanimator.
Oh, God. Okay, well, I guess he didn't learn much doing Stuck.
Wait, what happens at the end of Stuck? Give away the end of Stuck.
Well, the end of Stuck, it ends, it's like a horror movie. It ends, you know, it's a contest between, Nina Suvari and Jeffrey Rush. And I'm not going to give away the ending, but I did feel like I talked about that scene at the end of Black Water where she's got the severed limb and the gun and she's covered in mud. Stuart Gordon blew his chance to do that kind of ending in Stuck. I think Stuck had a good premise and could have had an amazing visual at the ending and he kind of fumbled it. So there you go. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Jeffrey Rush.
Yep.
You mean Stephen Ray?
You know they look very similar. Yeah, you're looking that up, aren't you?
No, Stephen. What are you talking about?
I forgot. Do you never confuse Stephen Ray and Jeffrey Rush? Is that just me?
Not really.
Okay.
Just their names both have an R at the beginning, at the end.
And they both have a funny accent. So.
But their hairlines aren't the same, which is all I go by.
That's a good point. All right. Oh my God, I can't believe I was doing that.
Why did you bring up Misery, Tom?
Misery, the thing where Kathy Bates has James Caan.
James Gum.
Shut up. Has him in a bed and he can't, you know, he's wounded from having been in a car wreck. So she has to, you know, he can't move and he's being terrorized by someone who'd normally be weaker than him. And Stuck is the same thing.
It's interesting that you brought that up because I thought of Misery when I thought of this week's 3x3. Because
she cut his legs off though? She just hobbles him.
She just hobbles him, but in the book she cuts off one of his feet.
Oh, and then that's awesome.
And a thumb too.
She cuts off his foot and then she cauterizes it, and it's just such an awful moment when you're reading it. And then in the book, in the movie, she puts that thing and then she hobbles him by breaking his ankles, and it's such a different. It's so different to watch her break his ankle than to the idea of the sort of the audition style ending. And I, when I was thinking of this, I was like, can I stretch it? No, I can't.
All right, so in the book, she doesn't hobble him at all. She just cuts off his foot, or she does both of those things to him.
She cuts off his foot.
And his thumb later.
I don't remember the thumb, but
with an electric knife. It happens off screen even. And he's like mad about it. Like, oh, I just cut off my thumb.
It's just her cutting off his foot and then cauterizing it. I remember that whole thing. And then they didn't do that in the movie. Imagine the difference between cutting off a foot and then breaking the ankles. And it's a pretty amazing image of her taking that sledgehammer and breaking his ankle.
Right.
But it's a completely different thing.
The guy who wrote it, William Goldman, said he only did the movie because he wanted to do the scene where she cuts off his foot. And the studio was like, no, you'll lose all sympathy with her. And he was furious about it. And then after he saw the movie, he was like, actually, you guys were right. It would have been lamer my way.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you can't – severing a limb or an extremity, that's a huge thing in a movie. Like, that's – because that's one way. You know, it's like Ash cutting off his hand in Evil Dead or something. You know, that's serious stuff when you lose it. Or like your Empire Strikes Back thing.
How seriously did you consider Evil Dead at all?
No one uses the hand, and the hand it keeps doing stuff, so I don't...
Evil Dead use it.
that's true, maybe, yeah, the Evil
to
Dead.
To flip them off.
But not seriously at all, because I wanted to steer clear of easy things. And I still can't believe you did Barton Fink. Oh, you're such a jerk.
Sorry.
What an easy one.
Do you want to know what I almost went with, or should we just move on?
Seven.
No.
What else is there? I rattled off my other things.
I almost went with Sicko.
What the heck is that?
What? What part?
Sicko. Oh, that's a documentary, though. We talk about movies here, not documentaries.
Oh, my mistake. Sorry. Let's move on, then.
So, speaking of movies, what should we see next week? Should we see some
Single Man.
Should we see art house indie?
Let me put the brakes on. We have to choose next week's 3x3.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I thought we had closed the list down for good because... You've gone to poaching other people's selections, so.
Sorry, I've gone rogue. I apologize.
So, Dingus, yes, what do you have for us for next week? What's our next 3x3?
Wait, it's me?
Yeah.
All right. This is really inspired by a single man. And this is smoking. This is the best instances of smoking in a film. I'm thinking specifically of smoking business, of smoking, the way smoking is filmed lovingly and the way it's well used. I don't want any instances of actors being lazy and using smoking as a crutch. How do I say this? I love smoking when it's used in movies correctly. I love the idea of smoking, but I can't do it because it makes me sick. So I want you to think of, I'd really like specific scenes or specific bits of business, like when Colin Firth lights both of the cigarettes.
Nice.
And she comments on that, and the way it sounds. So I want you guys to try to think of either scenes or points of business where smoking is used so well that it makes you want to smoke. And I'm not speaking to either one of you specifically, but I'm talking about cigarettes here when we're talking about smoking.
No pipes or cigars?
I'm not talking about Mary Jane, as you kids use.
Oh, you're not talking about doing the pot.
I'm not talking about doing the pot. If you can think of something that breaks the rules, go ahead. But talking about cigarettes.
No smoking crack, no smoking heroin. That's not generally. So you mean right, cigarettes? I see. Okay.
And not being on fire, and that you have to be put out.
Ah. Okay.
So instances of smoking, specifically smoking business.
Good.
That works for you.
Well done. Good. All right. So do you think there's going to be any of that in Avatar? I wonder.
I hope so. It was in Mr. Fox, and if it's in a cartoon, it can be in another cartoon.
Mr. Fox is for kids, so there you go. Well, join us next week. We will be seeing Avatar next week or last week. I mean, whenever this falls into when you listen, Avatar will be opening pretty wide, so you'll have a good opportunity to see it. As a matter of fact, by the time you hear this podcast, you probably will have already seen Avatar by now.
And you're not listening to this because you're out at Avatar.
Exactly, yeah. So, I'm Tom Chick. I am here with Christopher Morosky, Kelly Wong.
That's me.
And we'll see you in a week.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing chair. Another kiss. The days are bright and filled with pain. And